Andrew, welcome to this week's Robin Pod. The viewers and listeners probably won't appreciate the amount of technical difficulties we've encountered to get you on the Robin Pod. And I think we both admit we are no technicians. So the fact that we're able to speak to you on the other side of the world and we've managed to navigate our way through the internet is, I think, a little success story for us.
Absolutely. We'll put it down to Melbourne.
Let's put it down to that. Andrew, I mean, you must be one of the busiest men in rugby league. For people who don't know, you're a curator at Rugby League Project. You're one of the hosts of Fergo and the Freak podcast, as well as just taking in rugby league in general. I mean, how do you find the time to fit everything in?
To be honest, the easy part is doing all of that because I just love doing it all. You know, the statistic stuff that I do, the history research, being the historian sort of stuff, chatting about rugby league. Let's be honest, it's all easy stuff and it's enjoyable to do. So I don't find it hard to find the time to do it all. And none of it feels like a chore or painful or anything like that. It's just something I love doing and have been doing it for nearly two decades.
Well, people are familiar with rugby league. Used it as a resource, googled it and got lots of information, but they probably don't realise, obviously, that you're one of the people behind it. How did it come about, and how did Rugby League Project start up?
It started up in very early 2000, I think around 2003, with Sean Dolan, who created the website, and he still runs the website now. And he basically started it because he wanted to track his team, the North Queensland Cowboys, and what all their players did. And it just sort of expanded from there. Around about 2005, I was working on writing a book and I was looking online for a bit of information about something. And I stumbled across his website then and just contacted him and said, we're both kind of doing the same thing. Why don't we just work together and go from there? And he's like, yeah, sure, no worries. Let's do that. And it just kicked off from there. And that was around 2005. We started working on all of the Australian club data from there, which has only just been finished about two or three months ago. So that's every lineup, every score from every NRL game going back to 1908. We'd spent a lot of time, probably for about 12, 13 years, focusing on trying to find all of the lost International Rugby League games that no one bothered to report on. That took a long time to get as well. We've got all of that done. And I'm trying to figure out the year, it's probably about 2009 or so, we had Bill Bates, the St. Helens historian, runs a Saints Heritage website. He came to us and he had all of this information about the, results from the games that have been played over in England. So ever since he was on board, we've been trying to, well, we have been working through transferring all of that data into Excel and putting that into the website, which is going to be available pretty soon on the website as well. So you'll be able to see all of the English club results going back to 1895 on there soon too.
Wow. And I suppose, I mean, for you and for the website, the accuracy is probably one of the most important things, because if you're going to put it out there and you're going to do it, you want it to be right. And, you know, like I said, people do use it as such a valuable resource.
Yeah. And I think the first thing we did when we started working together on this was we decided that if we kept going with the official data, we're not going to find out whether that official data is actually right or wrong. So we've been trying to steer clear of using official information and try and go through every other channel first, which is mostly going to be newspaper reports. And in the more recent times, you can watch video and stuff like that to get all that accurately. But yeah, trying to get as many other different sources to agree on certain facts. And if you're ever falling short or you're not too sure on something, then go to what the official league had. And, you know, last resort is always going to, in Australia anyway, going to the club as a last resort, because they were not too good at recording their own players' result, you know, records and stuff like that in those early 30, 40 years as well. So it's been trying to steer clear of that. And we have found a few errors along the way. One was a big one, which was with Terry Lamb. For a long time here, he only recorded as having 349 games. And we had on our database that he played 350. And we spent the best part of about 3 or 4 months compiling all of the information to prove that he played 350 games. We gave that to the NRL. And within about 2 or 3 weeks, they went through it all and agreed with us that that was correct. So they changed the official record. Wow. But if we had stuck with the official data, we would have been stuck on 349 just like everybody else was, and no one would have thought none the wiser. So that's just one of those really big examples, I guess, as to why it was good to steer clear of that official information. And we're constantly checking and reviewing stuff. I've got clubs who will come to us every now and then. Past players often come to us with information, and we'll go and research that. And, you know, it can lead to some other information down the line, or you may be able to make a correction somewhere. And that's the beauty of the site, is it's never claiming to be 100% accurate, and it's never claiming to be 100% complete. And it can evolve and can change and can get updated live immediately when new information comes to hand. So it's really brilliant in that aspect.
Yeah, and I suppose, I mean, it's no small undertaking itself. Running the website is maybe the easy bit, but the depth of work behind that, the networks you built up, the communication with other people, fact-checking things, you know, the research, you know, but you must spend countless hours, and I'm guessing you're always looking for willing volunteers to help you out.
Yeah, the research stuff is something that I really, really love doing, and I never really pushed too hard to find too many volunteers for a lot of the Australian stuff in the past, because there's few resources and there's not much we can work with there. But we have had, you know, 2 or 3 people who have been pretty huge in that process, that have been with the website the whole way through, and they understand the methodologies we use and how we intend to go through and get all that data and put it on the website, and, you know, why we steer clear of the official stuff as a first case thing and use it as a last case resort. And it's found a lot of information that has not been known for a long time. Basic stuff like players' first names that weren't known. You know, it's brilliant to be able to put that information on there, so people who may be related to that person down the line, and they may have only played like 3 games from North Sydney in 1930 or something like that, but they can actually find that person online now and go, oh my God, my great grandfather played this. And you go, that's one of those great joys you get out of it. And it's good to be able to do that.
Yeah. And I mean, one of the most important things, what many supporters will probably look forward to each year, is the Rugby League annual that you produce. I was happy to contribute to it for the latest edition. I mean, that's a huge undertaking in itself. Anyone will probably be checking that out, because the information, the stats, everything that's in there is so relevant, so important, so interesting. And that in itself, Andrew, must take up a hell of a lot of time to compile. I mean, when do you start doing that? During the course of the year?
I should be starting on that during the year, but I usually wait until just after the grand finals are done and go through it then. But yeah, it's still to this day the only yearbook that England, you know, that covers the English game with match reports of every Super League game, which it's still amazing to me that the English Rugby League doesn't have that sort of yearbook yet. I'm not saying anything negative to the ones that are out there, because there's a lot more games in England to cover than there is in the NRL. So that's going to be a much, much bigger demand. But we've got a great relationship with the League Unlimited website. And they have a host of writers who do live updates in the NRL games. And I've been very fortunate that a few of them have been more than happy to do match reports of every Super League game every year. So we can have them in there and we can record those games and, you know, everything that happens in the entire English season. And the whole thing we wanted with that yearbook was for, instead of having an English yearbook and an NRL one, or one favouring one or the other, I wanted it to be equal for both teams. So the data we've got for the NRL clubs, it's the same we've got for the Super League ones. The summaries at the end of the year, it's the same structure for both. You know, I didn't want to have one being getting less coverage than the other, because I think it's really important that we treat all the games equally. I'm not a big fan of someone saying that one game's stronger than the other. I like to think that they've all got their strengths and weaknesses and they're all great. And I just love watching rugby league. I don't care where it is. So it's really important for me that the both versions of the game are covered equally.
Yeah, it's really interesting that you take that viewpoint, Andrew, because as many people, especially over in our country, you'll look towards the NRL as being the pinnacle of rugby league almost, and basically whatever the NRL does and whatever the NRL puts out, that is the pinnacle. But it's interesting you took the viewpoint that it's all equal, I suppose. If you just love the game, you can appreciate every game, regardless of ability or where it's set in. Rugby league is just rugby league.
Oh, yeah. Look, and one of my greatest moments watching football was probably during COVID. And there was that one game that was played, I think it was in 2021, and it was between Germany and Netherlands. And they struggled so much to find actual recording equipment to record the game. It looked like parts of it was done on a mobile phone. And I love watching that. It's just something really like that. That is genuine grassroots type footy, but it's international football. You go, it probably shouldn't be broadcast like this, but at the same time, I so love the fact that we're doing whatever we can to get this broadcast. And it was one of the most enjoyable things ever because there was no commentary. All you heard was the crowd and the game being played, and that was it. And it was just, it's, you kind of forget that that's kind of what football is. That's what you want to hear. You want to, you know, when you go to a game, you don't hear the commentary. So it was very much like being there more than just watching the NRL or Super League on TV. I'll watch any old game of rugby league. I love it.
Yeah, I think we had a few gremlins in the system there, Andrew, so just caught the back end.
That's all right.
Yeah, a few gremlins there. Don't worry, I can edit that bit out. Andrew, you mentioned Super League. Of course, we're heading into round three, but this weekend we've got the start of the NRL. All the glitz and action for the NRL, are you on board with it? Are you a fan of it? Are you looking forward to it?
I'm not sure what to make of it. I think we've had so many attempts to take the main game over to the Americas, both in Super League and the NRL. I think I'm just a little bit more cautious than excited about it. It seems... All right. Whenever the NRL starts talking up this really big game about, you know, they keep having infighting over there. It'd be good to see that they're able to get that all sorted out and start having a unified comp and no more infighting, and they just go from strength to strength because we should have a strong game in America. Mm-hmm.
Hi, Andrew, can you hear me?
Yeah, mate.
Fuck it, I haven't got a clue what's happened, mate. It's just kicked me out. Right, we can carry on. Sorry about that, mate. Honestly, for some reason, I'm having major problems with my internet. I haven't got a clue why.
It happens, mate. It's a Western world thing.
yeah, first world problems and all that. It's not the biggest thing, but yeah, just appreciate it. Don't want to waste your time as well. So what I'll do is, I know you was talking about the NRL in Vegas. I'll just start again with that, and then I know you might have to be repeating yourself a little bit.
That's a fine.
yeah. Andrew, it's funny you mentioned about Super League, the start of the Super League season. We've already kicked off. We're into the third round of fixtures. The NRL kicks off this weekend in Vegas with the razzmatazz, the glitz and glamour. Is this something that you're on board with? Are you excited about? Because I know not necessarily every NRL fan is a huge fan of what's happening at the moment. Are you on board with it?
I'm quite okay with the game going over there. There's been a lot of attempts to go take the game over to America in the past, both in England and in Australia, and it's always come up with kind of mixed results, and nothing great's ever come of it, or it's never really kicked on. It's just seemed more like of a flash in the pan sort of thing that they do. So I'm not too sure how it's going to, you know, what's going to happen after the games are played when everyone goes back home. I'm hoping something happens, because we should have a strong presence in America, and they should have a strong game there. And I'm waiting more to see what happens after the games are played, more so than the actual game played themselves, if that makes sense. But I'd love to see it there.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. You keep hearing this phrase, trying to crack America, without anyone actually defining what that is and what cracking America is or what success necessarily is. I mean, if we're talking purely about the development of the game, you know, proper structured competition would be success. My worry is that the NRL are looking at it as another cash cow, and basically how they can reap more dollars from the game over there. And it is a hard market to tap into. Don't get me wrong. You only have to tap into maybe a small percent of the existing sports market. But every sport's trying to do that right now.
That's right. And you're 100% right. It does come across to me like they are trying to just get whatever money they can out of it. It's kind of the same. I feel the same way about all the talk about taking Origin over to Wembley and things like that. It's a great idea, but it just feels like another way of getting other people's money into the game, which is not a bad thing to be doing. But if you want to make it worthwhile, you need to make sure that you've got some long-term plan and you're going to give something back to the game there. The American Rugby League, their local comp, has been decimated by over the past decades through infighting and splitting the comps up and starting together and all of that. And all it does is just keeps holding the sport back there. So hopefully NRL makes a decent presence there. It can help to unify the local competition and actually make it stronger, which would be the biggest thing it can do. And the NRL needs to sort of step in and be a little bit more involved in that way. And hopefully this is a step in the right direction to achieving that.
Yeah, I mean, NRL wants to have its finger in as many pies as possible, because if you believe what Matty John said, they're interested in buying into Super League or buying Super League. So maybe we could be looking at a world NRL in a few years to come. Global rugby league controlled by the NRL. I mean, it does seem a bit pie in the sky and a bit fanciful. But I do think there's an opportunity to have greater synergy between the Northern Hemisphere and Southern Hemisphere, which for whatever reason, infighting, probably no one actually taking control of it. I do think we need to have greater synergy between the two comps and the two hemispheres.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It would be great. There's nothing I want to see more than English rugby league being really strong like it was in the 80s and the early 90s, because that just means that rugby league everywhere is going great. It genuinely does frustrate me seeing what I think is Super League has been treading water for the best part of the last 25 years. And they've had opportunities to actually do pretty good expansion and back it up. They're like, how many times have they been to Wales and not followed through and made a good fist of that? It's been frustrating to watch the whole saga with Toronto. You know, it's just, I wish they'd find a way to try and, you know, once they make that step, making that step's the hard part. They've got to accept that there's going to be struggles when those teams from outside England are joining into the competition. There's going to be struggles, and they need to take the risk to support them and try and make sure that those clubs and those teams in that game stays there and continues to be strong, because it's only going to improve the Super League and International Rugby League, which is also going to help Super League as well. You know, so, you know, you get the other problem, though, of, you know, finances. I don't think the NRL should buy the English Super League or the RFL or anything like that. I do think IMG are on the right track. They are going to learn, though, that it's a culture they've got to try and change, not a structure within the – not a business structure or something like that. It's an actual culture within the game they've got to change over there in England. And that's a big problem to fix.
Yeah, I mean If I'm honest, I don't even think the NRL need to entertain the idea of buying the Super League. I think if they was really serious, they'd set up their own comp, invitation only, and they'd make the Super League teams want to come and play in that in a franchise system like the NRL's run now. And who knows, you could invite American teams into that. That's, for me, where they'd have some real value. But buying into something that already exists, just I don't think could be attractive. I don't think they'd benefit from that, because they'd be buying into a structure that fundamentally goes against everything that probably the NRL, in terms of the finance and the way the business is run, there's no synergy between the two. So I'd love to see them set up their own comp and invite, you know, Wigan, St. Helens, Hutchinson Rovers to bid into it. But I just don't see that happening, not for a long time.
No, I think that god-awful 1997 World Club Challenge thing kind of poo-pooed those ideas a fair bit, because that was a brilliant idea, but they did push it together really, really quick. It was an absolute mess. I think the English clubs at the time thought that they were a lot more competitive with the Australian ones than they actually were. And I don't know. It was a messy thing. And I think ever since that, everyone's just been hesitant about ever going back there again. And that's more of an Australian rugby league thing more than anything else. I think the English have shown, to me anyway, over the years, that they're more inclined to try something a little bit different every now and then, to try and, you know, get more eyeballs on the game or try and get more engagement somehow. I mean, we saw it with the weird Super 8s thing. You know, sometimes things are going to fail, but they're trying something. But the NRL, like, every time they trial something and it doesn't work, they just go, right, we're never doing that ever again. They tried it with a draft of players in the 1990s. It didn't work once because of one player. Never gone back to it. The World Club Challenge thing was with a whole bunch of teams. Failed in 1997. Not going back to it. And that's something that I'm not very keen on, is how quickly NRL will shut down an idea if it doesn't work, instead of trying to improve on it or find out what was wrong and try and tweak it, make it better. Because I think that World Club Challenge was a genuinely brilliant concept. But they just got scared because it didn't go so well and wouldn't go back to it.
Yeah, and it's funny you mentioned the World Cup Challenge. Of course, we saw the Wigan Warriors triumph only a few days ago. We saw St. Helens travel down under. They triumphed, and albeit different stage of the seasons, player availability, referees, whatever. But what you would say, it was two competitive games, two sides who really wanted to win that. And I suppose they're maybe the seeds of bringing some greater synergy between the two competitions. The fact that the top teams, when they go toe-to-toe, it is a competitive game and the eyes are on it.
Exactly. That 100%. It proves that the top teams are a lot closer to equal than everyone cares to realise. You could argue that it's the first game Penrith plays in the year. It's, you know, Wigan or St. Helens, the previous time, had already played a few games. But, you know, I don't think that's enough of a reason to say that, you know, the result would have been much different. If Penrith had played three games already, are we saying that they would have come out and put 60 points on Wigan? Of course not. I don't think the result would have been that much different. Penrith got a few bad calls from the referee, but at the end of the day, if the Australian team did that much better, they wouldn't have been behind on the scoreboard when those things happened in the first place. So, you know, you've got to take the good with the bad. Penrith have been doing this thing for the last 2 years where, and it comes through a culture of winning, where they'll get close to the end of a game if they're behind. They just somehow find a way to get across the line. They did it against St. Helens in the World Club Challenge. They did it against Brisbane in the grand final, and they very nearly did it again against Wigan last week. They just know how to do that sort of stuff. And more often than not, it works. But, you know, last week it didn't work out for them. It was odd. There was some weird things they were doing in that game. The not kicking on the last. I think that was part because they were wary about the shallower in goals in England, but also to try and take the back three of Wigan out because they're very fast players. So if you're not giving them an easy 10, 20 metres, you're not giving them that chance to get around you. So I think that might have also been part of the plan they had there. But it didn't work too well for them.
Yeah, and if we're honest, I mean, we might romanticise the notion of the two competitions going head-to-head. Ultimately, it does boil down to pounds and pence and dollars and who's going to stump up the money, whether there's a TV deal behind it. And I think that is, I suppose, from a British rugby league supporters' point of view, many people like to compare the two comps, but in reality, we are worlds apart in the finances and the resources that are available, which is why, I suppose, we're not able to dictate or demand. We are, I suppose, often going cap in hand to the NRL to get on board with our ideas in the hope that they will, because the money numbers just don't stack up at their end.
No, that's right. It's a bit frustrating too. I think that there's a lot of different things that go on between the two comps that are very different. Rugby league in Australia is always to look at new markets to go into. Not saying that the English one isn't, but the NRL has a bit more. I think it's sort of hard to explain because the country is so large in size. We've got three different time zones, whereas England doesn't have that issue. Or it's not even an issue, it's actually a benefit because you can have games kicking off at different times and it doesn't impact what goes on with the TV. It actually helps in a major way. And because we've got New Zealand involved, that's another time zone we've got. So the NRL would be looking at trying to get a team out in Perth because they're 2 to 3 hours behind, depending on daylight saving time. South Australia can be half an hour to an hour and a half behind. You know, all these different time zones are all good things for TV rights deals, and that's something that England doesn't have much benefit out of. You know, you've got basically just your teams in England and France, and they're all going to kick off around the same time. It's very good to see, though, that the Super League is going to have all of their games televised this year. That's a huge step in the right direction. And that's going to be good for future TV rights deals, which that's where the NRL gets all their money from. And so it's a good thing that the English Super League are going back chasing that, because that's where you get a lot of sponsors from. A lot of money comes out of that. And from that, they can start moving forward with the plans they want to do to try and grow the game and expand it beyond that Northern Corridor, which is something they do need to do.
Yeah. And I suppose for every plus, there's a little bit of a negative. I mean, it's great to see all the games televised. The problem is, the clubs are maintaining kicking off at the same time. So like you alluded to, down and under, you know, you kick off at different times. So it means that every game has maximum exposure, whereas we're three games on at the same time, which is so then people are picking and choosing. But it is, you know, it's a start, isn't it? And I think that's the main thing, that they've got to start somewhere rather than just, you know, think it won't work. You know, they've got to get more exposure, and doing that is putting things on screen. So let's see where that goes. I mean, what, Andrew, what do you think the general opinion of Super League is across? And I'm asking you a broad question there, because you can't speak for everyone, but in your dealings with people, what do you think the general opinion of Super League is?
I think a lot of people in Australia would tend to think that Super League is very much a inferior quality competition. And What I mean by that is not so much that the top, say, two or three teams are inferior. We've seen more than often or not that they are not just competitive, they're equals to our best sides. But the drop-off from the top five or six is quite a big drop-off from, you know, what we've got in that area. So that's something that I think is concerning for a lot of fans in Australia with the Super League. Me personally, I've never been a fan of the promotion and relegation system because I just think that the teams that are constantly on the cusp of promotion and relegation and constantly going up and down, all it does is keeps chewing away their finances until eventually they just go broke and they just disappear. Like Bradford's a good example of that. And I think what's good for a TV rights deal is consistency with the number of teams you've got there. And you can't get that with a promotion and relegation system. I think English Rugby League needs to try and stop trying to copy the soccer methods that they've had in the past. They've got to have shorter seasons for the benefit of the players, for the benefit of the clubs, for finances. Because if you've got lesser games, that means every game has a lot more value to it. So you're going to get more crowds to the games, more money through the gates that way. You're going to get... you know, you're probably going to get more games televised. Because you've got fewer games, they're going to start wanting to move around the kickoff times to get more of them televised so that the TV viewers get more bang for their buck. And that's something that they need to do. Either that or they've got to just put more teams in the Super League. But, you know, they've got to do something in that area there. I think too many people in Australia are dismissive of the Super League competition, and I'm not on board with that mentality. I generally do like watching the Super League because it is a different style of football. I find it to be a bit more open than the NRL. The NRL is very much a defensive-focused game. And I like watching both. But, yeah, if you want to see good attacking football and fast-moving football, I think the English Super League probably delivers it a little bit more frequently than the NRL does. It happens in the NRL when a strong team's playing a really weak one. Whereas Super League just seems to do it on a much more regular basis. It doesn't matter who's playing.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned that, Andrew, because it's the teams over here who were able to defend a bit better who end up ultimately being more successful. And, I mean, we've seen that Hull Kingston Rovers, Willie Peters come in. It's the season now and already 3 games in. We're seeing a lot of solidity in defence. And I think his big mantra is... you don't need to win by a huge amount of points, but also you make sure that you don't lose them out by a huge amount of points. So if you're always somewhere in the middle, you've got more chance of winning the games. And I suppose it's that NRL mantra ethos coming through into Super League. And Willie Peters, I guess he was a bit of an unknown for us when he came over from Newcastle, but he'd been there and thereabouts as assistant, hadn't he? And his career path over in Oz, he'd done a bit of the hard yards as well.
Oh, yeah, and to be honest, a lot of those guys who have moved around a few clubs in Australia and even had a bit of a stint over in England tend to become pretty decent coaches or assistant coaches. They've seen a lot of different things. They've worked through a different lot of players and different coaches, and I just find they tend to become pretty good coaches all around. And you think Trent Robinson was a good example of that for a long time, was pretty successful. And he'd been in all three countries as either an a Roosters coach or, in France and things like that. So those coaches that get more exposure to, especially Super League and the NRL, I tend to find they end up becoming pretty good coaches. It doesn't matter where you put them. I think we're probably going to start seeing that with Christian Wolfe as well. So it's not a bad thing. Willie Peters is... He was always a very solid player as well. You didn't get much difference between his great game and his poor game. He was just very, very consistent and ultra-reliable. And that's a very good base for a coach. So I think he's going to have a pretty good season. And, yeah, he has been focused very heavily on the defence, which, I mean, you have a look at Penrith over here, and they concede 14 points a game over their last nearly 150 games. That's how you win premierships. It's good to see Willie's got that in his mind, because that is genuinely how you get those titles. And I think you'll find too, a lot of people in Australia would love nothing more than to see someone other than St Helens, Wigan and Leeds win the main title there. They don't even care who, just someone different.
yeah So we agree with that sentiment as well, Andrew. 100, and hopefully this season, because it has been such a long time. And it was, yeah, we've been guilty, I suppose, of looking back too long to the 80s and when we enjoyed, you know, a lot of success then, and it's time for a change in that. I mean, what, we've also announced a signing of Jared Warrior-Hargreaves. What's the news? How's that news being received over in Australia?
I think a lot of people, for not last year, but probably just before COVID, around there, they probably saw Maria Hargreaves at the end of his career then, because he was playing probably lower than his usual best. But his last two seasons have been probably two of his best seasons as a player at the Roosters. He's been absolutely brilliant and a genuine leader in that side. And I think you're going to find that the English game is going to suit him in his later years pretty well, because he's not lost any intensity. His work rate certainly hasn't dropped. I think, you know, those hard, rugged forwards are the only ones from Australia who genuinely succeed over there in England. And he definitely fits that mould. So I generally think he's going to have at least two very, very strong years as an absolute minimum. I do think he's a very good signing, and he's a genuine leader. He's a no-nonsense sort of player, which is exactly what you want. And yeah, still making good meters, still good defensively in the middle. He's a very good signing, and good for a lot of young forwards you're going to have in the side there as well.
Yeah, and I think that's what's exciting. If you forget about his age, his numbers still stack up, his appearances, his impact in games, but also the fact that he's a leader. And I know Willie Peters has been very strong on bringing people into the club who offer more than just the performance. It's what they do around the club, how they act, how they behave, how they carry themselves. And we, Sean Kenny-Dowell was probably the epitome of that for the last few years at the Robins. He retired last season. He's coach at the club now, and he probably helped set the standards that we've come to appreciate and enjoy at the moment at the club.
Yeah, look, that's the thing. They're both very much, especially JWH, very much a family man as well. Which is that's the sort of thing that I think goes over really well in English clubs as well, because the community that you're playing in is a lot closer knit than they are in Australia. You know, you tend to have your fan base spread all over the whole country down here, whereas up there, obviously, the fan base is very condensed and very local to where you're currently playing. So those guys who have got those strong family values and stuff like that tend to really enjoy being over there and playing there and living there.
Yeah, definitely. And like I said, we've got the start of the NRL this weekend. Who's your tip for the comp? Is it going to be Penrith again, or can you see them being challenged a little bit further this season?
To me, it's going to be pretty hard to go past probably three teams: Penrith, Brisbane, and Melbourne. I kind of look at it as to which teams, when they get into the finals, you just know they've got that extra gear that they can go to when they need to be better than the other teams. And those three teams, especially Penrith and Melbourne, have proven that they've always had that in the, you know, last three seasons, four seasons. And Brisbane are definitely back on that, back in that conversation. And you often see it in the NRL, you lose a grand final, you either flunk out the following year or you get better. And that Broncos side is very, very, very well assembled. Got a great mix of youth and experience, very fast moving side, and their defense is getting better and their attack is supreme. So, I think it's going to be between those three. And probably the Rabbitohs will be a bit of a smoky if Latrell Mitchell can stay fit for a year.
Yeah, and one thing that I really want to do get your opinion on, because I know you've been vocal about it on the podcast, is the new rules that have been implemented in terms of tackling over in the Super League. I mean, it's funny, we've just been talking about Jared Warrior-Hargreaves, about how he's going to probably have to adapt his technique from what he's used to in the NRL to Super League. There's been a lot of noise around some of the sendings off, sendings, bans players have received. What have you made of it all?
Yeah, we get these crackdowns every now and then in the NRL, and I think sometimes the game handles them the wrong way. So the crackdowns are genuinely necessary and they're the right thing to be doing, but I don't think send-offs and sin bins are the way to do it. I think just penalties will do. That's punishing enough. We saw one the other day, which was, you know, everyone was laughing about the head clash that happened, and there was nothing malicious about it whatsoever, and the player got sent off. And you just think that's not teaching anyone anything. How do you avoid a head clash? You know, sometimes you've got to accept that in body contact sport, accidental head knocks are going to happen with two people. Who's going to willingly put their head in front of someone else's head running at pace? It's just nonsense. So you've got to accept that those errors are going to happen. But when people do something that is malicious, or even if it's a sloppy technique, like a swinging arm or something like that, even if it's lazy, you can punish that a bit more harder. But accidental things, head knocks, stuff like that, that's just bringing a, you know, bad news to your game for no genuine game, because that's something you just can't avoid. It's a contact sport. Like, that's just going to happen. We had it here a few years ago where any contact with the head automatically was met with a sin bin. And I believe it might have actually been Jabaria Hargraves himself, who he was bracing for a tackle with his arms down beside his legs. So his hands were down near his knees, and the player fell in a tackle and their head hit his hand and he got 10 minutes in the sin bin. He wasn't swinging his arms or anything. You just think, he's not even trying to hit him in the head. He fell into his hand, you know, and these crackdowns are all well and good, and they try and think that, you know, if we have no grey areas, then we'll be fine. But there are grey areas and there are accidents in the game. I don't think we have people out there like we did in the 70s and 80s being malicious anymore. I think those times are gone. So the need for sending off has been reduced immensely because of that. And we need to kind of preserve the send-off for the genuinely serious things. I think things like accidental head knocks, it's just nonsense. Like, a penalty is more than enough. You know, because you can even argue that that's over the top, but at least with that being over the top, it's still 13 on 13 on the field. You know, and the momentum's changed, the other team's got back into the game, that sort of thing, and that can be enough. At the end of the day, it's a game about results, not about who's on the field and who's not. So, yeah, it's one of those things you don't want to howl at the moon too much about it being too aggressive, because the purpose behind the rule change is a good one, protecting players' heads and their brains. That should be something that we do. But you've got to accept that accidents do happen, and you can't just be black and white about it, because that's, you're just making yourself look stupid in that sense. Because you're going to, you know, another referee might pick that head clash up and just say that, yeah, that's just a genuine accident. And everyone's going to go, oh, but that bloke got sent off last week. And, you know, you just, it's a mess. It's a mess. So it's,
yeah. Stuff like that. There has been kickback from the players and coaches. Apparently, the players and coaches held a meeting with the RFL last night to discuss and give their opinions and thoughts on it. I'm in two camps. I do think for a long time, a number of players have probably got away with just being lazy and using poor technique and almost pointing to the referee or the judicial system as being the problem and not them. So I think there is an element where players need to get better, and they have to get better, and they need to be penalised if not. But like you said, there's probably a little bit of a grey area there where accidents will happen and there's nothing a player can do. So hopefully after round three, you know, well, we've got, you know, this weekend's games coming up, we're going to start to see a little bit more common sense applied. And in essence, you know, the rules have always been there. You know, if you take somebody's head off, you're off. It's not being unusual. It's more just going too far down the line in terms of your accidental collision, because sometimes a player cannot put them anywhere else, or the hands anywhere else than where they are. And I expect they've got a responsibility to protect the person who's been tackled, but that person who's due to be tackled can take full advantage of that as well.
Exactly. And that is a problem that you get in rugby league, not just in Australia and England. It's everywhere. Is if there's a chance to find a loophole rugby league coaches and players will exploit that loophole. They'll find it, they'll exploit it, and they'll use it as much as they can. So that's kind of why the referees do use that, you know, let's have no grey areas approach. But, yeah, you just got to accept that it's going to happen. And that, look, that's the beauty of having match review committees to issue out suspensions. All they need to do is just ramp up how long a player is suspended for. That can have just the same impact without impacting the actual game being played at the time. You know, so there's ways around it without it being foolish, I guess.
Yeah, and Andrew, if people want to hear more of your opinions on the NRL Rugby League in general, Fair Go and the Freak podcast, where can people hear you and find you on that?
Oh, man, we are literally everywhere on iTunes, Spotify, just everywhere you listen to your podcasts. You can check us out on there. The good thing is if you go to YouTube to find us on there, you don't have to look at my ugly mug. So that's handy. And, but, yeah, we've got a good mix of opinion. I mean, yesterday we did our season preview for the NRL. In January we did a brilliant history episode looking at how the media reported on the birth of rugby league at the time. So all the lead up into from 1901 through to 1908, to the birth of rugby league in Australia. And so the reason why we did it through the media perspective, looking at newspaper articles, is to get an idea as to how the fans and the spectators would have seen how that game came to be, instead of just going with all of the actual facts of what was going on. There were still facts, but leaving out some of the background stuff that the media never reported on, and looking at how the media would jump at shadows a little bit and rugby union would respond to the shadow jumping, and that's kind of that played a massive role into players jumping ship into the other code as well, which hasn't really been explored before, which was very fascinating to find out as well. But yeah, there's a good mix of everything on there, which is pretty cool.